Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the renowned poet, essayist, playwright, and scholar, Elizabeth Alexander. Alexander is currently a professor at Columbia University. She is author of 6 collections of poetry, including American Sublime, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. She composed and delivered a poem praise song for the day at the inauguration of President Obama in 2009. And her most recent book is a compelling and beautifully written memoir about the sudden death of her husband in 2012, just a few days after his 50th birthday. It is called The Light of the World and was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize in 2015. I'm talking to Elizabeth Alexander by phone from her home in New York. Elizabeth Alexander, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking.
So the Light of the World, it's an absolutely amazing memoir, but I want to start with the first lines. You say in the opening lines that it seems to begin with a catastrophe, but it's not a tragedy, but a love story. So tell us about your husband and tell us about the experience that you had.
Well, I was very fortunate to meet by magic, so it seemed, a very extraordinary man named Fikre Ghebreyesus. And I think that part of after cut ahead to the chase, we lost him very, very unexpectedly in 2012. And in the process of grieving that loss, what I realized was indelible, what I realized could never be taken away, was the power of being loved by such an extraordinary man and entering into a relationship and building a family that lived in love that we tried to share and also lived in art and culture and a culture of the world that we also tried to share, that was something that I learned could never die. That even when the person dies, all that we have, and in our case for the 16 years that we had together, is something that stays with you for the rest of your life. And so in the process of very unexpectedly writing a memoir, which I never imagined I would do, about his loss, I found myself sort of writing my way to the fullness of what he gave me and so many others.
Mm-hmm. God, it's an absolutely beautiful book. And I want you to talk about the fact that when you found him, he fell off a machine in the home gym, and you found him on the floor, you and your sons. And you said you felt his soul was still in his body when you found him. Tell us about that. That is so fascinating.
Well, I would say that it was a very mysterious experience that I could only, as I did with so much else in the book, try to narrate with as much honesty and precision as I possibly could. That I was a witness to so many things that I didn't necessarily understand, but that I needed to write and share in the best way that I possibly could. So the feeling of, you know, what is it that is essentially us? What is our soul that lives inside of our bodies? I think that you know, most of us would agree that body and soul are in some way two different things, but feeling and being with someone at a moment of passage from this earth to whatever is after was a very profound moment to bear witness to.
Yeah, the way you talk about this, it's absolutely amazing. Now, you asked the question about what does it mean to grieve in the absence of religious culture. Now, it feels like this book was a meditation of sorts and a spiritual, almost a religious experience, at least for the reader, me. To talk to us about what you found in answer to that question.
Well, I did not grow up as a regular churchgoer, and I think that one of the things that organized religion does for people is that when you are faced with the power of death and when you are laid low by that, religion tells you what to do. It tells you where the people are. It you know, someone is there to shepherd you through the wilderness of grief, mm-hmm. and all that you kind of can't manage in that moment. And so I really wanted to think a lot about, you know, when you don't have that in the conventional sense, what, in fact, do you have when you've been making village, making extended family, and believing, as I do, that there are so many ways that we can belong to community, even if we don't necessarily belong to one that's been standing for a long time, and that you can borrow elements from one that's been standing for a long time. And in my case, my late husband came up in the Coptic Orthodox Church in Eritrea, and so it was a Greek Orthodox Orthodox priest who welcomed us and said, I will be one of the people who is your shepherd. Mm. I will carry you through.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. You know, I've spoken to a lot of poets. Do you feel like poetry is a kind of religious language for you? And is that how you translated this grief in a way,
well,
because you are a poet?
If what you are is a poet, then what you have is the word. And if in the beginning there was the word, and that's your medium, and that's your material, that's your raw material, that's the way that we give ourselves and our souls to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we have to work with. So I think that in that regard, I wouldn't necessarily say that poetry is religious language, but I certainly do think it is spiritual language.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that you began writing at least bits and pieces of this book almost immediately after Fikre died. Is that true? And I can't imagine that you were able to do that.
Well, it's funny. I wrote because it was a way that I could understand what was happening to me. It was a way that I didn't even feel that I could make sense of what was happening, but that I could almost experience what was happening, because otherwise I didn't know what I was in the midst of.
Mm.
Because his passing was so unexpected, because he had been a seemingly healthy person to us beforehand, it was, I come back to the word, a wilderness. And so the grounding of my hand on the table, my hand on the desk, my hand writing and making words was what helped me simply move forward. It wasn't even as advanced as kind of, I am sitting down to write, I am sitting down to tell, I am sitting down to write a book. It was more, this is a way of staying alive.
Mm-hmm. Do you understand why you weren't just writing poetry and you started writing this narrative? Because it almost feels like you invented a new language as a poet, at least for yourself, to describe like absence or something.
Well, I think of the book it's a prose book, but I think of it as being written in tiny poet's chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So each of those short chapters has the distillation of a poem, and each of, you know, as I said, with every word I was saying, is this what I mean? Is this true? Is this what's happening? So
mm-hmm.
that kind of scrutiny and pressure, I mean, I'm always very, very meticulous with my work, as poets must be,
mm-hmm.
but I felt like that meticulousness and exactitude was like completely next level, because I was in such unfamiliar space. And so what came out of that was a memoir that perhaps was written in a way that only a poet would choose to write, even though they weren't poems.
Mm-hmm. It's such beautiful language.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, even if I didn't know you were a poet, I would have thought, my God, it's a poet that wrote this. I hope she realizes that she's a poet. Now,
that's nice.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. And I heard you say in an interview that you used the term that I hadn't really heard about, the exhaustion of grief. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, in my experience, and I've seen this in many other people, you know, who've gone through tremendous loss, grief is uniquely exhausting. I mean, you know, you carry on as you must, and you do what you have to do. And in my case, we have children, and my children were 12 and 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had to focus on them first. I had to go back to work. I had to earn a living. I had to do things. I had to manage all of the people. You know, suddenly you become a widow,
mm-hmm.
and that's a role. And people have expectations in that role, and people have needs of you in that role, or wishes. So that is profoundly exhausting, because whatever the physical work is of processing grief, it would be interesting to see what a doctor says about that, because I am sure that your body has to work to move through shock and grief.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I can imagine. Now, tell us how your sons were 12 and 13, I believe, when your husband died. Tell us how you decided to put your sons in this book, and did you talk to them about about it? I know you're brutally honest in this book, and I've heard you say that in interviews, that was your goal, to be as honest as you possibly could be. Did you ever think about the vulnerability of having your sons in this book?
Absolutely. I mean, I had to think about that because I had to, you know, as I still do, as is any mama's job in life, is to protect them and try to do what's best for them. So I wrote without, and I was always clear, even after I signed the contract for the book, and I said this to the publishers, that if my sons were in any way uncomfortable with it, that I would not be able to publish it, and I would just give them back the money. You know, I mean, it seemed like I had to say that.
Yeah.
And so I did share it with my sons, and the difficulty of that was thinking, you know, they are moving on, and it's hard to calibrate when talking about it and going into the grief is a good thing, because you don't want to suppress and act like this enormous thing didn't happen.
Yeah.
But you also, you know, want them to find the way, collectively and also individually, that they need to move on. So, you know, I made very, very careful space and shared it with them at two junctures. And we had very powerful conversations where they, you know, they laughed and they cried and they talked about things that they remembered and remembered differently. And that turned into a quite fascinating conversation about the nature of memory and about what emotional truth is. You know, if they remember that Daddy's jacket was red and I remember that it was blue, what is more important even than that, which is, you know, what is the feeling? What is the emotional truth? And so the book is definitely published with their permission.
Did you encourage them to write?
I think that, yes, in as much as, you know, I mean, I'm also a lifelong educator. I think everybody ought to write as a way of sorting through and coming to clarity. I think that writing is a wonderful, wonderful tool for everybody. But with my sons, you know, that they have to do a lot of writing in school, and, you know, they're getting older now, but they're both actually very, very good writers, and that's nice to see.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elizabeth Alexander. We're talking about her beautiful memoir called The Light of the World. It talks about the sudden death of her husband in 2012, just days after his 50th birthday. Now, you mentioned also once when I was listening to you that you couldn't read or write or listen to music. I mean, not write, but you couldn't read or listen to music right after this. To tell us what you were doing instead.
Well, I would want to start first with how bizarre it was not to be able to read or listen to music.
Oh, bad.
You know, every single day of my life since I learned how to read, I've read a lot. That's what I do consistently. And music is also something that I really, really love to have in my life. With reading, it was the exhaustion and the inability to concentrate that I just thought, there is not room in my head for one other molecule of anything.
Mm-hmm.
With music, it was that music viscerally took me so powerfully to a place of extreme expressive feeling.
Mm.
And I didn't want that to be out of control all the time because it was already so enormous. But then as I came back to those pleasures and those necessities, I found that there was so much that I needed there. Listening to music was a source of, you know, I wanted the feeling that music took me to once I sort of collected myself. I wanted the feeling of those rich and beautiful voices sort of entering my body in the way that music does. I wanted the joy of music. So after listening to a lot of music, I entered a stage where all I wanted to do was dance, where all I wanted to do was just be embodied and dance, and feel that joy of aliveness. With reading, to return to the pleasure of learning and reading and knowing and taking in was like having my vision restored. It was an amazing thing. So with both of those, it was kind of a lost and then found.
Yeah, you know, I've had other people on who've written memoirs about death and loss of spouses. Did you feel that numbness that a lot of people talk about? And I was thinking perhaps that's why you did start dancing and finally getting back to music, because you must have gone through a period perhaps of numbness or not.
Yeah, not numbness for me so much. That's kind of, and I think that, you know, everyone is different, of course. And one of the things that's been really interesting about the journey of sharing the work of this book is that grief is such a commonality. Grief is such a unifying experience because it's a common denominator, and suffering is a common human denominator, mm-hmm. but everybody grieves in their own particular way. And even within the griefs that we'll encounter, we experience them, of course, very, very differently. But for me, numbness was not anything that I felt. And I think having my children and, you know, just trying to wrestle the ability to be emotionally present for them was kind of what overrode everything.
Yeah, and they were at an age where they weren't going, when's daddy coming back? And they understood the concept of death, I would assume, at least fairly well at the age of 12 and 13.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, they absolutely did. So, you know, it was just managing that loss, which is, you know, that is theirs forever, as it is mine forever, but you know, it is also different for them. Yeah. It's their father.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Talk about the importance of food in your family. You even published some of Fikre's recipes, which I found really beautiful and heartwarming. Tell us about that. He was a chef and a painter.
Yes, yes. He was an amazing chef and a painter, and he and his brothers for 16 years ran a restaurant in New Haven called Café Adulis, a beautiful, legendary space with just amazing, amazing food. And so I think that, you know, coming together at the table and preparing food that was healthy and beautiful to look at and brought people together and created an occasion for just, you know, sharing our humanness, always having an extra space at the table. That was a kind of an ethos that was really, really, really important to both of us. And that was how we lived our lives. And so in order to recreate the texture of our lives, because after in the memoir going through the kind of what happened, this was the loss, then the next important narrative step of the book was, well, who are these people? Why should you care about this loss? How can I, you know, take you someplace where you can experience, where I can share what felt like a really, you know, rich and beautiful and magical life. And ritual and food and culture was a big part of that. The recipes that I included, it was really, really fun, almost from a poet's perspective, to use the language of recipes and of different kinds of recipes as another kind of poetry for the book.
Yeah, I thought they were really fascinating. What happened to his paintings? Will there ever be an exhibit? Are you keeping his work alive or keeping it, you know, private? And
No, absolutely. His work, he himself was someone who just painted and painted and painted, 882 paintings,
wow.
Many, many, many photographs. And he was shy about showing. He always said, you know, my job is to make this work. And I would say, you're a genius. It should be out in the world. But it's just funny how life turns out. You know, I'm so grateful that we have all this work. So we had a very big show in New Haven with a catalog a year after he passed. And there are other things that are in the works. And there's a really beautiful website where people can see his work and read his artist statement, fikregebreyesus.net. So we very much are going to be sharing the work with the world.
Yeah, and I just want to tell my listeners, both the hardcover and the new paperback book have some of his paintings on the covers. So,
yes.
They're very beautiful. They're very colorful, which I love.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Now it's been, what has it been, 4 years, Elizabeth? How has grief inhabited you as the years go by? Does it change? Can you explain what the passing years have brought you in regard to this?
Well, you know, I think that at the end of the day, you know, as I said, you know, grief is something that you can't outrun. Loss is something that we all encounter. And I feel that what we're left with is life and the privilege of being alive and ultimately the privilege of being able to carry extraordinary people with us. I really believe, and maybe, you know, some of it relates to my work as an artist and as a scholar, that you carry forward the voices that came before you. Mm. You have to. You know, we exist on a timeline. We don't exist only in the present. We exist in relationship to the people who made us, to the people who shaped us, to the works of art. And, you know, reading poetry and talking about music, all of that is a very important part of the book. The art was my companion moving through this grief. Mm-hmm. And art outlasts us all. Art is eternal. So I feel that, you know, we're alive now and we live as best we can and we honor the people who taught us and gave us so very, very much. And as I feel completely altered evermore by grief, I also realize that I am altered evermore by this extraordinary person and all that I learned in my time with him. So, you know, we're evolving creatures, and we just hopefully can keep moving forward in this really, really interesting life we live.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you're kind of giving an ode to the ancestors, right? Because, I mean, it carries on through your sons, and we owe a lot to the people who came before us. And I found that in your book, too, which I found really moving and really, it really touched me deeply as well. Now, you physically moved from New Haven after Fikre died, and you guys moved to New York. Was that the right move? Was it the only move? Did you have to leave like that? And tell us about that transition.
Well, I, you know, New Haven is a wonderful place where I raised my family, where I had wonderful and amazing work teaching, you know, incredible young people at Yale University, where Fikre, you know, after life as a refugee, landed and made a beautiful life and business for himself. So it's a place to which I owe a great deal. But New York also was someplace, it's where I was born, it's where somewhere we always intended to go. And for my life as a writer, for my life as a creative person, and for the possibilities that I wanted to show my children, that you can make a change, you know, you can have a change that flattens you, but then you can also actively make a change towards something that is hard and challenging, but absolutely magical and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what our time in New York has been. We have always had many, many, many very close people here, but I think also seeing that you can belong to another world and find treasures there and belong there was a very, very important thing for us all to experience.
Yeah, I can imagine. It makes sense to me for sure. Now, have you been able to write poetry? Are you writing poetry? Are you writing about Fikre? Are you writing about the past?
I feel, you know, that's a question that everyone asks me, and I always feel
a little
starchy
when I hear that question. It's because we love your poetry, Elizabeth. We love your poetry.
Well, I know, and I always say, but I just wrote that book. That's a big book.
It
was hard to write. Leave me alone. I'm replenishing. I do feel like I left it all on the table, but you know, the well will always fill back up again. So there will be time for that.
And when you wrote this book, I know we talked about how you started writing right after he died. How much of it did you have to? How long did it take you to write this? Did you go back for years and add things and bring back memories? And how did you put this book together?
No, I wrote it very intensely. I wrote it in about 9 months because I knew that the stage I was in, I started writing about a month after he died, and I knew that I was in a state that I wouldn't be in forever.
Mm.
And I knew that I was in a state that I couldn't be in forever. So not only did it feel like a necessary thing, but once it sort of got going, I thought, capture this time. Capture, because you won't be the same. I also had some sabbatical time, and I knew that there are other kinds of writing projects that I've been able to do while I've been teaching or doing other work, but I knew that this was not that kind of thing, because every time I sat down to write, I went into such, you know, intense emotional terrain, and it would have been very hard to accomplish all the other things that I would need to do in a day. So I wanted to use that precious time.
God, you know, that is such a gift to all of us. I'm sure maybe you thought this was a gift to your family and to your husband's memory when you were writing it, but God, it's such a gift to us that you were able to pull yourself together to write this absolutely gorgeous memoir. I am absolutely flabbergasted that you were able to do that.
Oh, well, I feel lucky that I had an art form. You know, I feel really lucky that I had somewhere to go with all that was happening to me. I've always felt just lucky that I'm a poet. I love poets. I love other artists. I feel so special to belong to that tribe. I feel like those are special, special, magical people whose antenna are open to the world. And as someone from as long as I can remember, you know, I just always felt a lot. Mm-hmm. And poetry has given me something to do with that. So I just feel like, thank goodness, I get to do this to help me make my way through.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to know if presenting this memoir to the world has changed your relationship as a public poet to the world. And have you noticed changes in the way people react to you and some of your fans and poetry lovers who know you?
Well, you know, what's different about the people who love poetry are such special people because, you know, everyone says poetry is dead. Well, poetry's not dead. There are many poetry lovers. But what's different about this book is that, first of all, the accessibility of prose and memoir, more people find an easier way into it. And because there's a very, very clear story, you know, this happened to this woman. This is a grief memoir. Mm-hmm. So people find me sometimes because of the writing, but sometimes because of the story. And so what's been fascinating about that is that I have connected with so many people about their own losses and about love. I mean, when I meet young people who say, your book helped me believe that real love could be around the corner. Your book gave me a way to see what I want in a relationship. You know, when I talk to first-generation Americans, I mean, that's a big thing in my book as well, or people who are, you know, first-generation Americans and longtime Americans in relationships, marriages, families, and talking about that wonderful cultural coming together and all of its possibilities. You know, it makes me so happy that the story has captured so many in its net and that I'm getting to connect and learn from all those people.
Well, great. Well, I guess we'll end on that note. Again, I've been talking to the poet Elizabeth Alexander, and we're talking about her memoir, The Light of the World. Absolutely beautiful. Go out and get it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tish. This was really, really lovely. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.